then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 15th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. We'll start out with a few leftover odds and ends from the past couple of weeks on Radio Free Northwest. To begin with, there's an Edgar Steele update, although it's not really an update, since by now most of you will already have heard that Steele has disappeared. According to the correctional staff, he is no longer in the Spokane County Jail. The jail people refuse to say where he's been taken and may not even know. The Spokane County Sheriff says that Steele is in the custody of the U.S. Marshals, but so far the Marshals are denying any knowledge of his whereabouts. It's true that Steele is still listed on the jail's website as an inmate, but his visitors are being turned away, his mail has been returned, the jailers have denied that he's there to people who call on the phone, telling people that the U.S. Marshals took him away, and the Marshals Service have refused all comment. No one has received any phone calls from Steele, including collect calls, which is something completely unknown for prisoners who are on remand and who have not yet even been tried, other than one letter smuggled out to a woman named Ingrid Castle in Bonner County, Idaho, who's the widow of the former publisher of the Idaho Observer, plus the two phone calls which seem to have been set up by the government to entrap him. No one has received any communication at all from Edgar Steele in 6 weeks. There has been some speculation that Steele may have been extraordinarily rendered to Guantanamo or some Eastern European country where he can be tortured, although to what end they would do that I can't say. The government objective, frankly, seems to be to keep Steele away from anyone who has access to the internet and who might publicly discuss the growing number of oddities and inconsistencies in the federal case against him, not the least the fact that their own informant, Larry Fairfax, has since been arrested for the attempted murder of Cindy Steele. My own guess is that Steele has been taken either to Chicago, which is where the feds love to take so-called white supremacists for trial because they know what kind of judge and jury they can get, or else if he's had some kind of health issues relating to his recent open heart surgery, he's been taken to the federal prison medical complex in Springfield, Missouri, although if that's the case, I'm not sure why all the secrecy. As of Tuesday, July the 13th, no one has been able to locate him in the custody of the U.S. Marshals. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he did have a second heart attack just brought on by the stress and he died and they're just not bothering to tell anybody. I just got off the horn with Jim Giles from Radio Free Mississippi, who told me that he'd spoken with someone in the public defender's office, although not with Steele's lawyer himself, and whoever he spoke to assured him that Steele was still alive and the public defender's office was in contact with him. But in view of the fact that you're dealing with attorneys here, that's not exactly a credible source. Always remember, an attorney is first and foremost an officer of the court, not an officer for you. His or her first loyalty is always to the system itself, the system that feeds them and pays them money and gives them power over the lives of other human beings, which is the greatest turn-on for police and attorneys. Long and the short of it is that Edgar Steele has now been arrested and held almost completely incommunicado for 6 weeks, and he has been allowed no meaningful contact with anyone outside the prison walls except for one smuggled letter, two surreptitiously recorded phone calls which appear to have been arranged in order to incriminate him and deny him bail, and one brief court appearance. Now, while we're on the topic of Edgar Steele, I'd like to get into something else here that bemuses me. Now, granted, before all this happened, I was never one of Steele's big fans for reasons I won't get into, but now I'm being attacked for supporting him. Like most movement personalities, Steele had a lot of enemies in our incestuous little circle, apparently, and now they're all coming out of the woodwork. I am amazed at how many enemies he seems to have made. One of the things I find a little disturbing is all these people who are suddenly appearing on the internet screaming and hollering that Steele is guilty, 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 based on nothing more than what little the government has released and based primarily on the fact that these people don't seem to like him. I won't be so naive as to talk about presumption of innocence. We all know that that went out the window in this country long ago, but all of a sudden it's like Edgar Steele has a lynch mob chasing him down the information highway. One of the more weird aspects of this case is that so far only myself and Alex Linder seem willing to stand up and defend Steele in public. Talk about irony. Another irony is that if I'd been the one arrested on some kind of fabricated charge, I very much doubt that Steele himself would have defended me, never mind Linder, who won't even allow any mention of the Northwest Imperative on VNN. But what can I tell you? Politics makes strange bedfellows. Guys, let me run down for you exactly why I am defending Edgar Steele, at least to the extent that I am defending him. There's three reasons. First off, I'm one of these dinosaurs who happens to believe in the old ways, like presumption of innocence and due process of law, both of which Edgar Steele is being denied here through being held incommunicado. Secondly, the fact is that there are more and more bizarre and questionable twists to this story emerging. Now, it seems as if the FBI informant, Larry Fairfax, was in fact planted on Steele at least 6 months beforehand, with the specific intention of setting him up in a murder-for-hire plot. Whereas the original government assertion was that Fairfax just happened to get propositioned by Steele one day, late in May, and he immediately went running to the FBI to report it. So the government is changing their story, and as any cop can tell you, when somebody in a legal case starts changing their story, that's usually a good sign that somebody's lying. Finally, this happened in the Northwest, on my turf, and as a Northwest nationalist, my position is and must be that the United States is an occupying power here, that the laws and the courts of the United States have no legal or moral authority here, and that the FBI is a criminal organization completely lacking in credibility, which it is. If an FBI agent told me the sun was shining outside, I'd take an umbrella when I left the house. After atrocities like the murder of Sam and Vicky Weaver and the mass murder at Waco, and the abject failure of these agencies to protect Americans from real terrorism over the past 10 years with relation to the many unanswered questions about 9/11 and so forth and so on, I could go on all day. The long and the short of it is that a federal court no longer has any true moral authority in this land because the government that it serves is no longer legitimate. A federal judge is nothing but a political gangster in a black robe working for a nigger and a few Jews at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and that judge's power is enforced not by law or by consent of the governed, but by his personal army of gunmen from the cops and the FBI. I would defend any white man caught up in this horrible legal mincing machine, no matter what he's accused of doing, because until there is real proof of wrongdoing, the accusers simply cannot be believed. The United States has lied to us way too often on the big things for them to be believed on the little things. Right, another leftover from 2 weeks ago when I talked about immigration procedures to the United States for British nationals, I got several emails mentioning or asking about fiancé visas for American immigration. Yes, there is such a visa, but they're almost as hard to get as a green card itself. Again, a quick reminder, I am not an immigration lawyer, and so don't quote me on any of this like it's gospel. Also, the situation may have changed since I last read or heard anything about this, but to the best of my knowledge and belief, the story on fiancé visas is as follows. An engaged couple must essentially file two sets of paperwork, one here in this country with USCIS, the U.S. Customs and Immigration Service, and a second set with the United States Embassy in the country where the foreign fiancé lives. I don't know the full set of requirements, and I'm sure you can find those on various government websites, but my understanding is that you must have physically met your fiancé at least once. Now, this is to prevent arranged marriages, and it's also a feeble effort on the government's part to shut down a lot of these damn mail order bride agencies that import Asian and Eastern European women into this country as wives for American white men who are sick and tired of dealing with American women and their dysfunctional hang-ups, and who go to somebody like Sunshine Girls or Scanna International in the desperate hope of finding a wife who's a partner in life and not a screaming, castrating bitch for whom everything always has to be about her. Of course, you never know what you're getting with these internet mail-order bride outfits. I'm sure some of these Russian and Romanian females who put all those hot pictures online are normal women looking for a better life who are so desperate to get the hell out of some crumbling Soviet-era apartment block in Poland or the Ukraine that they're willing to more or less prostitute themselves to some fat, bald Larry the Cable Guy type in bumfucked Wisconsin. And to be honest, that's what this is. It's a form of prostitution. When I lived in Ireland back in the 80s when there was 20% unemployment, before I got married, I used to have all these fine young Irish girls coming on to me all the time in pubs and at work and in my theater group, which puzzled me because even at 29, I wasn't exactly Brad Pitt. And then I realized that these girls thought I was a rich Yank, since any American in Ireland has to have money, right? They thought I was going back to America and they were looking for a green card. When they found out I wanted to stay in Ireland, which I did at that time, they dropped me like a hot potato. But it's also unquestionable that a lot of these women listed by these mail order bride agencies are real prostitutes, drug runners, and general gun mauls for the triads of the Russian mob and other criminal elements who are basically trying to get a string of girls into the West with legal green cards. Sometimes these girls are even given instructions by the agency on how to get around the USCIS requirement that they stay married for 2 years before they can get their green card. There's a special legal exception to the immigration rules for so-called victims of domestic abuse, and so what she has to do is stay with you a couple of months, then bruise up her face herself, or hire some local hoodlum down at a bar to smack her around in a back alley, and then she goes running to the police claiming, "Oh, my wicked new American husband is beating me." As a quote-unquote victim of domestic violence, she gets her green card right away, but there's a catch there, where hubby is concerned anyway. In order to prove that she really is a quote-unquote victim of domestic abuse, she has to file charges and get a conviction before USCIS will give her the green card, and they say true romance is dead. Now again, some fallout from the past couple of episodes. I get a lot of Dutch uncle letters, or nowadays Dutch uncle emails, telling me all about how I'm screwing up and telling me in some detail how I really should be doing things. One guy, for example, tells me that I'm wasting my time trying to get young people interested in all this old-timey music, that young whites don't understand any of it, they can't relate to it, and which I'm sure is largely true. Of course, if they never hear any of it, they'll never have a chance to relate to it. Now, that's one reason I have the musical breaks in here, to try and teach white people about their heritage through music. And it seems to be working, at least a little. I'm in contact with a young woman who's really getting into some of the medieval mellows. She's bought CDs from Ars Musica and the Sequentia Ensemble, Hildegard von Bingen, and so forth and so on. Yet the first medieval music she ever heard in her life was just a few months ago here on Radio Free Northwest. Until then, she didn't even know anything of the kind existed. She heard a few pieces I played on here and it blew her away, and so here's a white girl on the way to rediscovering part of her heritage and her past thanks to all that antique old-timey stuff. Now just to be clear, I'm not ragging on this one guy who complained this week. He's not alone in his opinion, not at all. I've gotten this before. People claim that in order to attract young people, I should be playing modern rock music on here, and they've made suggestions. One person wanted to hear Britney Spears, for example. You know, the crazy bimbo who shaves her head and puts on a funny British accent sometimes when she's in one of her fugue states during her endless custody battle, etc., etc. One guy wanted to hear 70s disco and sent me some pretty good suggestions, including a couple of songs I remember from the 1970s myself. I downloaded them and I play them on my computer, but I'm not going to put them on Radio Free Northwest because it's not racial music. And anyway, if you weren't there at the time, you'll never get it. Now, I will tell all of you guys again what I told the comrade who brought this up this time. I am dead serious about getting more participation in this thing of ours here. This is not a challenge to anyone. It is a sincere and heartfelt invitation. If you think you can do a better job than me at podcasting or any aspect of anything we're doing here, then by all means, step up to the plate. If this gentleman or anyone else thinks that doing a Northwest Freedom podcast or a leaflet or a YouTube video with Britney Spears soundtrack or whatever will draw in more young white people, and you're willing to risk the copyright infringement, which practically speaking would mean you just get pulled off YouTube, then by all means, step forward and lay it on us. You can get participatory in two ways. You can do a 7 to 5 minute audio clip in MP3 format and send it to me, or you can just plain hit the ground running and do your own thing. Send me what you do, and if it meets meets certain basic standards of what the Germans call Linien Treu, I will be happy to plug it on our websites, circulate the URL, etc. Now, as to what I mean by Linien Treu, I mean you can't be preaching communism or sodomy or accepting Jews as white people. You can't be talking religious apocalypse or rapture crap. You need to go easy on too much space alien or occult stuff. We don't want to get like David Icke talking about how we're secretly ruled by lizard people or anything like that. Just common sense, really. Stick within some common sense parameters and make sure you make a good racial point and Bob's your uncle. I will not only approve of it, but advertise and distribute your work. Also, I reserve the right to disapprove or decline to distribute anything of really poor technical quality, sound you can't hear, really bad video editing, anything that'll make us look bad and amateurish. And I think that might be more of a problem than content. To be honest, I probably wouldn't have approved the first 7 or 8 fireside chats of my own on technical grounds. In that first Radio Free Northwest, where I actually played the first music break on $10 Kmart speakers, in the background. God, that was awful. I've said this before, people, and I'll say it again. Don't tell me what I should be doing or how I should be doing it. Show me how you think it should be done when you step forward and do it yourself. And for all I know, maybe this comrade is right. Maybe Britney Spears or techno rock or heavy metal is the way to get young white people to listen to us. But we'll never know unless somebody gives it a shot, will we? Right, first music break. Folks, for some reason, I'm in a Civil War mood today, and I think I'll play a Confederate music selection for all three of our breaks on this one. Of course, we just have to start out with Dixie, but I mean the real Dixie. Now, some of you may have picked up a smattering of the official, i.e. Union History of the War, that they teach in schools and on TV, and you may have heard that Dixie is an old black minstrel song which was allegedly adapted by the South, and the version that most people know and sing today is so true. But that's because the actual Confederate version of the song was prohibited after the war, and then the old veterans from that time died out before the days of recording, so there was no way to keep the actual Southern lyrics alive in people's memories. They were seldom sung live, so they've been forgotten. Now, this is the original Confederate national anthem with the Southern nationalist lyrics, which were written by General Albert Pike, who, interestingly enough, was a Yankee born in Massachusetts. Now, that's another little tidbit you never hear about the war, the fact that just as there were some Southerners who stayed loyal to the Union, there were also a number of Northerners who supported the South's right to secede as a matter of political principle, and a fair number who actually served in the Confederate Army, although the records keeping on the Southern side was kind of sketchy, so no one knows exactly how many. Anyway, here is the real Dixie.
Saber, two arms in Dixie. Shoulder pressing close to shoulder, let the odds make each heart bolder. Two arms, in Dixie. Advance the flag of Dixie, hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand and live or die for Dixie. Two arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Two arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Dixie, away, away, away down south in Dixie, away, away, away down south in Dixie.
First email question for the day from Ron in Richmond, Virginia. Dear HAC, how do you think Obama and the Democrats will do in November's congressional elections? Do you think the Republicans will succeed in taking back both houses of Congress? And if so, what will happen then? Well, Ron, yeah, I think the Republicans will do well in November, but not quite as well as everyone expects. You have to remember that, effectively speaking, whites are now outnumbered in this country insofar as the electoral system goes. It's true that, technically speaking, whites still outnumber everyone else, and even when whites officially become a minority in a few years' time, we will still be the largest minority, followed by the Beaners, the Niggers, and the Gooks, in that order. The problem is that of age. Along about 2020, when the baby boomers finally start dropping dead in large numbers, the white population percentage in North America will really begin to plummet. But as far as such things as elections go, we're already effectively outnumbered. I've explained this before, but we need to go over this again to make sure you internalize it. Spaced repetition and all that. The American electoral system is rigged in favor of the non-white minorities through a system of checks and balances that was put into place in the Constitution in the 18th century and which, ironically, was originally intended to protect the poor whites from exploitation by the rich landowning and merchant capitalist class of the time. You have to bear in mind about the Constitution that it was created in a time when America was all white and virtually all Anglo-Saxon and Protestant, or at least Germanic and Protestant, and no one could envision the United States ever becoming the monstrosity it is today. Specifically, the House of Representatives and the Electoral College are both weighted in favor of population centers. In our 21st century world, the big, huge megacities like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, which did not exist and probably could not even have been conceived by the Founding Fathers. Where do at least 90% of the nation's non-whites live? In the top 100 metropolitan areas, where they can live in the projects and collect welfare and have access to all the white man's goods and services and be surrounded by their own kind. Now, where are most of these top 100 metropolitan areas, population percentage-wise? In the 8 so-called battleground states, New York, Illinois, California, Texas, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Those are the states with the most votes in the Electoral College, and those are the states with the largest number of congressmen due to population-based apportionment. Get those states in any presidential election, and to hell with the rest of the country, you can get elected president. Not coincidentally, all of those are blue states, with the exception of Texas and occasionally Florida, with all the white retirees, both of which are now majority non-white states, and both of which I predict will turn blue officially in the 2012 election. In November, there's no presidential race, true, just congressional elections, and yes, I think it's possible that if the votes are counted honestly, and we always need that proviso with American elections these days, if the votes are counted honestly, the Republicans may take back one or both houses of Congress as a white backlash against Obongo and his Jews and his incompetence and his Marxism. And if that happens, frankly, I suspect it may well be the Republicans' last hurrah. Because let me tell you what will happen then. After the November election, Obama will rush a lame duck Democrat majority Congress back into session in Washington. Many of these Democrats will have already been voted out, and so they'll have nothing to lose. And those that were reelected won't have to face the voters again for another 2 years, and they know that the American memory is just as short as the American attention span. In any case, as Rush Limbaugh has pointed out, many of these people will be fanatical liberal ideologues to the point where they will be willing to lose their own seats and their own majority in order to get certain vitally important parts of the left-wing liberal agenda passed. And of those, probably the most important right now is so-called immigration reform, because that's what will produce the two or three generations of minority bloc votes necessary to ensure perpetual power for the Democratic Party. In between November of 2010 and January of 2011, when the last of the Republican Congresses is sworn in, the Democrats will pass some kind of amnesty bill, the main feature of which will be a so-called path to citizenship, which will allow for millions of Beaners to be naturalized and given the vote just in time for the 2012 presidential election, thus ensuring Obama's re-election. But that's not the worst of it. Amnestying the 20 or 25 million illegals, however many there are, will in essence create so many anchor worker babies. The newly amnestied Beaners will in turn bring into this country and legalize and give the vote to at least 40 or 50 million of their relatives. Bingo, the United States is henceforth part of Latin America. Spanish becomes mandatory and the Democrats are in perpetual power. The liberals will have achieved their paradise, until the Spics and the niggers find they can't play nice, in which case we really do become part of Latin America, complete with ethnic cleansing and death squads. You know, guys, when that happens, it may well turn out to be too late to flee Northwest with anything but the shirts on your backs. Who's going to want to buy your house that you're so concerned about if it's in the middle of Nuevo Tabasco or whatever the Beaners change the name of your town to, huh? So maybe you guys better start packing that moving van now, eh? Next question from Gretchen in New York. Dear Harold, would you agree that the threat of extinction is global, or do you really think it is just this continent? Dear Gretchen, let me spell it out for you. The Jews want all of us dead. All non-Jewish white people of European descent. All of us, everywhere. We frightened them very badly from 1933 to 1945. They realized that under certain circumstances, it's possible for an entire nation to wake up and see them and recognize them for what they are. The Jews have never been so frightened as they were during the Second World War, and I believe that is when they made some kind of collective, subconscious decision as a race to kill us all before we killed them. I think it's no coincidence that the push for racial integration in this country and the relaxation of immigration laws began in the years immediately after World War II. Gretchen, guys, I can't put it all any simpler than this. This is a war to the death. It's either the Jews or us. Either we kill them or they kill us, and that's the name of that tune. Time for our second music break of the evening. In addition to many Northerners who fought for the South, there's another myth about the Civil War that I've always wanted to see dispelled, and that is that the Irish immigrants fought entirely on the side of the Union, which is just plain bourgeois. Okay, it's true that the actual number of Irish soldiers who fought for the Union is almost certainly greater than the number of those who fought for the Confederacy. Now, that has to do largely with the fact that the main Irish immigrant population centers of the time were in New York, Boston, Chicago, the Pennsylvania coalfields, and other northern areas. However, there were also extensive Irish communities in places like Charleston, Savannah, New Orleans, and Richmond, not to mention scattered all over the rest of the South. Now, this idiotic idea that liberal historians try to push about how the idealistic Irish leaped to arms for Abraham Lincoln in order to free the poor enslaved black man out of sympathy because of the oppression they suffered from the British back home is horse manure. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Irish despised the niggers, especially the newly freed slaves who crowded into the slum areas of New York and Boston and Chicago after the war broke out and took all the jobs from the Irish, who were living hand-to-mouth under the best of circumstances, and forced most of the men into the military. Same reason young men join the army today. They can't get a job at home because all the jobs are being taken by illegal Mexicans. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, The Gangs of New York, but if not, see if you can catch it. It's the only time I've ever seen Hollywood deal at all with one of the great historical embarrassments to the Union that occurred during the war, the New York City draft riots of 1863. Now, 2 years into the war, the Union was running out of volunteers, and so they had to institute conscription. Except under the system they set up, a rich man or a rich man's son didn't have to go. All he had to do was pay some poor man $300 to be a substitute, more often than not some poor paddy just off the boat who had no idea what he was getting himself into. Now, that's how most Irishmen ended up in the Union Army. They needed that $300 in their army pay to keep their families alive in some tenement in Brooklyn or South Boston. There is an especially poignant scene in The Gangs of New York where they show starved and dazed Irishmen staggering off one of the immigrant ships onto the dock, where they're immediately rounded up by soldiers. Some bureaucrat shoves papers in their faces and tells them to sign. Then they're handed a blue coat and a rifle and informed that they've just been drafted. It's not known exactly how many Irishmen fought for the Confederacy. Most estimates are between 35 and 40,000. Some of them served in the regiments from their various states, where they were living at the time when the war broke out, especially South Carolina, Georgia, Louisiana, and Virginia. But there were at least two specifically Irish units. One was Kelly's Irish Brigade with the Army of Northern Virginia, and the second was a cavalry brigade called McCausland's Rangers or Raiders, commanded by General John McCausland. McCausland himself was born in St. Louis, but his parents were Irish immigrants, so he was second generation. In 1864, McCausland took over where Jeb Stuart left off when he was killed, and McCausland's Rangers made a number of long-range, deep-penetration cavalry raids into Pennsylvania and Maryland during the last 18 months of the war that tied down thousands of Union troops, destroyed supplies and factories, and tore up railroad tracks, that kind of thing. Anyway, this is the song of the Confederate Irish Brigade. I think my favorite lines are, "The Irish green shall again be seen as our Irish fathers bore it, a burning wind from the south behind, and the Yankee bows before it."
Not now for the sons of a nation's wrongs, not the groans of starving labor. Let the rifle ring and the bullet sing to the clash of the flashing saber. There are Irish ranks on the tented banks of Columbia's guarded ocean, and an iron clank from flank to flank till the dawn remains. And the Franks' souls there clear, true and bare, to all as the seal beside them, and love or hate with the strength of age till the grave of the valiant tie them. It seems to be Milagre, whose sword avenging glory must light the fight and smite for right like a blinding lord. And the panic flight shall that sturdy Yankees face and hollow. Here a Celtic race from their battle lace charge to the shout of Baba Baba. By the soul of love, by the land that we love, her tears bleeding patience. The sled is a rock that shall smash to knock the brazen fire of nations. Irish green shall again be seen as our Irish fathers bore it, a burning wind from the south behind and the Yankee rout before it. O'Neill's red hand shall purge the land, rain a fire on men and cattle, till the Lincoln snakes in their own cold legs plunge from the blaze of battle. The nails that rest on Columbia's breast and the voice of true men stifle will exorcise from the rescue rise our carries and the rifle. For a tyrant's life of holy knife of a union of dissolvers, the best we can our stalwart and Columbia and revolver. Shall a march by triumphal arc, where may swell the slaughter? Our drums shall roll from the capital or the throne of Satan water. The rise bleeding goes to the Lord of hosts for judgment final and solemn. Your fanatic horde to the edge of the sword is doomed, line, square and column.
Now for something completely different. I'm going to give you guys a little talk on the romance of Jewish names. At our 4th of July shindig here in the Seattle area, some of our guys were batting the breeze and the topic came up of where the Jews came from. Are they of satanic origin? Whatever. I wouldn't go so far as to speculate on that, but I will say that the Jews do seem to have certain characteristics which have to be genetic in origin because these people display these very same visible traits everywhere they go, in every era, in every country, in every culture where they've ever been. Now, when you read responsible and intelligent historians and commentators from all over the world, spanning a period of 40 centuries, in different languages, representing different cultures and ways of life, ranging from ancient Rome to Cochin China to medieval Germany to Benjamin Franklin and Mark Twain to Tsarist Russia, all of whom make the same observations and remarks and level the same accusations regarding the behavior of these people, then I think it's pretty obvious that there's something to it all. As a kind of example, most people, possibly including many Jews, don't know how the Ashkenazi or Yiddish-type Jews got some of their most well-known surnames. Now, back in the old days, I mean the really old days, Jews did not have family names as such. True, most people didn't either, except for the very high nobility who didn't have families, they had dynasties. But ordinary Joes in the Middle Ages would be called after their place of residence or their trade. John of Ipswich or Adam the Shepherd or sometimes Son of, like many Irish and Scottish names, beginning with Mac, MacDonald, MacPherson, so forth and so on, which became clan names. How our own people got our names is fascinating and complex in itself. Jews in the Middle Ages were the same initially. A Jew might be called Isaac of York, like the character in Ivanhoe, or it might be called Jacob ben Reuben, which means Jacob's son of Reuben, etc., etc. Now, some Jews developed trade-related names as well, most notably the Rothschild family. Rothschild means red shield in German, and in medieval Frankfurt, where the Rothschilds originated, a red shield over a shop was generally recognized as a pawnbroker symbol, just like the three balls are today. Jacob Rothschild got his start as a pawnbroker under a red shield, hence Rothschild. But most modern Jewish names didn't appear until the late 17th century, when one of the Holy Roman Emperors, who ruled from Vienna over large parts of Austria, Poland, Galicia, and Central Europe, where there were large numbers of Jews, decreed a new census. Someone pointed out to the government that Jews were still not using proper family names like most other people were doing by then, and accordingly this made them very hard to count and keep track of, and of course to tax. And so the emperor signed a decree ordering that his Jewish subjects, for the purpose of the census, were to take official family names and register themselves under those names. Now, most of the Jews were allowed to choose their own family names, and I think the names they chose reveal a lot about the Jewish psyche, which has remained unchanged down through the ages. A huge number of Jewish family names from this period have to do with money and treasure. For example, Goldberg and Silverberg mean mountain of gold and mountain of silver, respectively. Goldstein and Silverstein mean jewel of gold and jewel of silver. Goldblum means flower of gold. Goldbaum means tree of gold. Fine gold means just what it sounds like, fine gold. Goldman, as in Goldman Sachs, means man of gold. Goldfarb means the color of gold. Now, these guys really, really like gold. In fact, in Israel, there's a pop song from the 1960s, I think, which has become kind of an unofficial second Israeli national anthem. It's so popular and well-known. The song is called Jerusalem of Gold. Rothstein means red jewel, a ruby. Greenstein means green jewel, or an emerald. Rosenthal and Wiesenthal are short for older forms of Rosenthaler and Wiesenthaler, and a thaler in early Germany was a coin, the ancestor of our word dollar, so that these names especially mean red dollar and white dollar. You get the idea. The Jews have always been obsessed with money, literally worshipped it. In fact, the biblical word shekel is shekel, which means little god in Hebrew. The unit of currency in Israel today is, you guessed it, the shekel. Some of the names these people chose for themselves or had assigned to them by the census takers probably had to do with trades they practiced. Kaufman, for example, means salesman. Fleischmann means butcher, presumably a kosher butcher who was usually one of the few actual manual laborers in a medieval Jewish community. There are a few ancient Hebrew names like Kohen, which means a Jew who was descended from one of the high priests in the old Temple of Solomon, and Kaplan, which is one of the few Khazar words that has survived. No one's quite sure what it means since the Khazar language is now extinct. There are a few nice names as well, like Morgenthau, which means morning dew, and Rosenblum, which means a rose. Glick means luck, presumably good. The suffix witz is the Eastern European equivalent of a place name. It comes from the Polish and Russian element of Yiddish, Moskowitz, Hershkowitz, Dershowitz, so forth and so on. And from these names, you can track whatever godforsaken little shtetl that an individual Jew's ancestors came from. But sometimes, Jews ended up with some really grotty names, and my guess is that for whatever reason, they refused to cooperate with the emperor's census takers, gave them a hard time, and generally acted obnoxious like Jews usually do, and so they ended up getting assigned some really bizarre names. Pector means troublemaker. Gans means goose, and Gansfleisch means goose meat. Imagine having to go through life with a name like goose meat. Weintraub means wine thief. Halter means hangman's noose. Feigenbaum means the tree of hanged cowards, apparently some kind of gallows they hang deserters on. Ochsenschwanz means oxprick. Ruchter means lunatic. Wiesel, as in Elie Wiesel, means exactly what it sounds like, weasel. Okay, I know this is getting a bit academic for you guys, but the point I'm trying to make here is that seemingly little things like language and the origin of words are very revealing. It may look boring at first, but if you really want to know why people are like they are and why people do what they do, you should study their language and how they use it and where it came from. I'll give you a hint. Start out with a book by a Jew named Leo Rosten called The Joys of Yiddish. Look over all the words and proverbs and examples in that book, and you'll notice something. At least one-third of the Yiddish words listed in there are terms of abuse and insult and belittlement, both against Gentiles and against other Jews. My favorite is Schmendrick. That's one thing you can learn real quick just by looking at their language. Jews are really, really full of hate. Hatred for others, hatred of themselves, hatred of life. They're some really sick puppies. Okay, let's meander on towards the third music break. Some people have critiqued my novels and compared my fictional Northwest Volunteer Army with the Reconstruction-era Ku Klux Klan. Close, but no cigar, not quite. You have to remember that the Klan, throughout its long and colorful history, was never trying to bring about a revolution in the South. Indeed, it would have been a lot better for everybody if they had done. No, the Klan was always trying to preserve the status quo, to keep the niggers in their place, so to speak, whereas we seek to create an all-white homeland for our people, where the niggers, Jews, and muds have no place, if you see the difference. Now, the closest historical parallel to the NVA in this country's history would be the Missouri guerrillas who fought for the Confederate States of America during the Civil War. Small, irregular cavalry units led by men like William Clark Quantrill, Bloody Bill Anderson, and George Todd. They were actually fighting to end federal control of the South and establish a new nation, as we will be one day. The border war is a largely unknown part of this country's history, and I'm not surprised because the political and social establishment in this country has always found it very embarrassing, since the Confederate guerrillas were a lot more colorful and they also had an inconvenient habit of usually winning. I'm going to start by playing you a passage read by a gentleman named Dave Parra on the subject of the Missouri Rebel Irregulars. I'm not sure where it comes from, but judging from the language, it's probably more or less contemporary, either from a 19th century news article or one of the first books ever written about the Frontier War. The reading will be followed by a song called Guerrilla Man, sung by Kathy Barton and Dave Parra, and featuring an Appalachian folk instrument called the mountain dulcimer. Now, when I first heard this song, I wasn't sure it was authentic because it seemed a bit out of place for the 19th century Americans to use a word like guerrilla. It sounded kind of stilted and artificial. But I did some checking, and sure enough, in contemporary usage, such as the newspapers and military reports and other official documents of the time, while both sides called each other bushwhackers, the Southerners were usually referred to as guerrillas, while the Union irregulars from Kansas, led by a United States Senator named James Lane, were called redlegs because they wore red flannel leggings instead of uniforms. Anyway, those of you who are curious about my concept of the Northwest Volunteers, here's a blast from the past for you.
They had passwords that only the initiated understood, and signals which meant everything or nothing. A night bird was a messenger, a day bird a courier. They knew the names or the numbers of the pursuing regiments from the shoes of their horses, and told the nationality of troops by the manner in which twigs were broken along the line of march. They could see in the night like other beasts of prey, and hunted most when it was darkest. No matter for a road, so only there was a trail, and no matter for a trail, so only there was a direction. When there was no wind, and when the clouds hid the sun or the stars, they traveled by the moss on the trees. In the daytime, they looked for this moss with their eyes, and in the nighttime, with their hands. Living much in fastnesses, they were rarely surprised, while solitude developed and made more acute every instinct of self-preservation. By degrees, a caste began to be established, free to come and go, bound by no enlistment and dependent upon no bounty, hunted by one nation and apologized for by the other, merciful rarely and merciless often, loving liberty in a blind, idolatrous fashion, half reality, half superstition, holding no crime so bad as that of cowardice, courteous to women amid all the wild license of pillage and slaughter, steadfast as faith to comradeship or friend, too serious for boastfulness, and too near the unknown to deceive themselves with vanity. Starved today and feasted tomorrow, victorious in this combat or decimated in that, receiving no quarter and giving none. Astonishing pursuers by the swiftness of a retreat, or shocking humanity by the completeness of a massacre. A sable fringe on the blood-red garments of civil war, or a perpetual cutthroat in ambush in the midst of contending Christians. Is it any wonder that in time the guerrilla organization came to have captains and leaders and discipline and a language and fastnesses and hiding places and a terrible banner? Unknown to the winds.
Thank you.
This email is from someone using a female name whom I won't identify because, to be honest, I'm not sure if this question is sincere or if it's a heckle. But heckle or not, it's a legitimate question. And the question is, Harold, what if you fail? What if no one ever responds? This gets into the whole basic question of why I, or anyone else, would embrace this whole seemingly pointless and frustrating lifestyle. And since it's my goal to get as many of you as possible to join me, I better have a good answer for that question. I'll give it a shot. Most normal people would say that someone has to be nuts to live like I do, and from the standpoint of so-called normal society, they're right. So why would anyone do it? Why spend your whole life fighting for a country that doesn't exist and may never exist if we can't somehow put some stiffening in our spines and find some physical courage from somewhere? Why would any sane person knowingly and willingly embrace a way of life which entails poverty, pain, pitiless persecution, and total alienation from what's loosely called normal society? I don't do this because I expect any reward and not because I expect to see the day of victory, although I believe now that some of you listening to me will see that day. I didn't always. I don't do what I do because I seek power for its own sake. If all I wanted was power, there are a hell of a lot easier ways to get it by working through the system, like becoming an FBI agent, for example. I do what I do because it is right. No other reason. We all have a duty to live as moral beings and to fulfill our obligations to ourselves, to our people, and to our Creator. And that is why we will win, and the dogs in the $1,000 suits will lose, because they do what they do only to feed their own greed and ego and hatred. They have no higher purpose than their own wretched existences. We have the highest purpose of all. I mentioned this before in one of my books when one of my characters describes the difference between white people and the mud people. White people are the ones who learned in the Garden of Eden the difference between right and wrong, whether it was through Eve chomping on an apple or some other way. The blacks and the browns have no knowledge of sin, no understanding of right and wrong. All they have are desires and appetites, like other animals. It's true that I seem to be up against a stone wall, but if you'll pardon me for paraphrasing Lenin for the umpteenth time, it is a rotten wall, and a few good kicks will knock it down. I think that's one of the things I've always had the most difficulty in conveying successfully to you folks, my utterly irrepressible sense of optimism and hope and faith in the eventual victory of our cause. That's why I get ticked off when you people ignore what I say on these podcasts. Damn it all, I am asking you to back a winning horse. You are the seed from which a whole new Aryan world will spring forth in coming generations. Yes, I know how hard that seems to believe right now, what with all that's going on, but it's true. I know this, but it's not enough only to believe. One must act, which is what white men have been conditioned from birth not to do. So I do what I can as one individual. And if every one of you did what you could, everything you could, then our victory would be assured. It's like that guy I referred to earlier who thinks I should be doing podcasts playing modern rock music to attract young people. Harold's Top of the Pops or whatever. Obviously, I don't think that's the thing I should be doing, or I'd be doing it. Personally, I think any music past about 1983 sucks. But who is to say that's not what he should be doing? If I could persuade him to step forward and do his thing with his Britney Spears and his Metallica or whatever, then there's twice the chance that one of us would be right. To try and get back to the question, what will I do if nobody ever actually does respond to anything I'm saying on here? If you mean, am I ever going to give up and quit and go off in a little corner somewhere and cry in my beer and wait around for the end, no. I knew a guy like that once, a former Ku Klux Klansman from back in the days when the Klan actually meant something. About 10 years ago, he sold up all his property in Georgia and moved to the island of Maui, of all places, and when I asked him why at the time, he told me flat out that he was giving up, that he was so sick and tired of the movement and all the idiotic goat-dancing people in it that he was so sick of stupid white people who had their heads stuck in a TV or a computer and who just couldn't be bothered, that he was surrendering. He actually used the term making his peace with the system. He said he was moving to the most interracial place on earth where total race mixing had already occurred so he wouldn't have to grow old watching it happen in North Georgia where he was born, and that when his time came he would simply walk into a nice warm ocean one day and just float away. I told him then he couldn't do it, and I was right. Oh, he's still out there, basically because now he can't afford to come back, and he likes the weather well enough, but that's about all. He's making a living doing something for all the super rich people who use Maui as a vacation spot and hideaway, and I suppose by system standards he's got it made. But he's never dropped out of touch. He still sends in his $10 every month, and he's going just as nuts out there watching Obama destroy everything as he would have done if he'd stayed in Georgia. The point I'm trying to make is that you can never really quit the movement, not really. Once you've ripped the television cable out of your brain, you can't plug it back in again. Once you know, you can't force yourself not to know. Once you understand, you can no longer be ignorant ever again, even when you want to, even when ignorance would truly be bliss. I'm like everybody else. I can't ever stop knowing the difference between right and wrong, between good and evil. I can never stop knowing about the Jews or pretend that I don't know. The difference is that to me, that knowledge demands that I act on it and I act effectively. If I thought that by strapping a bomb on my body and blowing something up and myself along with it would bring about change, I'd do it. But that's not the way it works in real life. The entire system has to change from top to bottom. And for that, I need help, your help. That's what I'm doing out here every week. I'm not lecturing you. I'm not scolding you. I'm not trying to show you how effing brilliant I am or say, ha ha ha, look how dumb you are. I'm not trying to con money out of you. I'm not trying to get your approval or get you to go ooh and ah and applaud. I am inviting you to join me. Most of you understand what that means, and that's why you're scared shitless to respond. But someday, that will change. And if it doesn't, then I just keep on trucking. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anandban. Freedom.